You know, when you sent over all that research on what happens in the brain, well, during death,
Right.
I don't think either of us realized just how fascinating it would be.
Yeah.
I mean, forget scary.
Yeah.
This stuff is really gripping.
It really is. It's a journey for sure. You know, we've thought about death for centuries as just this abrupt ending, like a light switch just turning off. But
Right?
what's really remarkable is that neuroscience is showing us that it's a lot more intricate than that. It's really like a carefully choreographed finale
Oh, wow.
with maybe some unexpected, you know, surges of activity.
It's like the brain has a couple of encore performances planned,
Yes.
even as the curtain's coming down.
Exactly.
And speaking of encores, one of the things that your research highlighted were those fascinating studies about gamma waves,
Yes.
which, you know, those are the brainwave patterns linked to consciousness,
Right.
and they seem to actually spike right before death.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it?
What did your sources have to say about that?
Yeah, so a number of your sources, and especially that groundbreaking study from mentioned a specific source, really dove into this. And it turns out that instead of this smooth decline that you might expect, the brain activity, especially in that gamma frequency range, can actually surge in those final moments.
So while the rest of the body is shutting down, it's almost like a part of the brain, at least for a little bit, is like flaring to life.
Yeah, it's not really flaring to life in the way we might think about it, but it's more like this kind of this last burst of energy, like a release of like this pent-up electrical potential as the system powers down.
Yep.
Imagine like a city's power grid and it's shutting off. You might see some unexpected surges and flickers of light right before everything goes
Oh,
dark.
that's a great analogy, like a last hurrah before
Exactly.
the lights go out.
Yeah.
I like that. That paints a really vivid picture.
Yeah.
But I think I want to make sure we take a step back for a second, make
Yeah.
sure we're all on the same page.
Nice.
For anybody who's maybe not as familiar with this, what's actually happening at the cellular level in the brain as the body starts to shut down?
So it's all about energy. And as you know, your brain is this incredible network of billions of neurons, and they're constantly communicating with each other, sending all these electrical and chemical signals back and forth. But all of that requires a constant supply of oxygen and glucose, which is delivered through the bloodstream.
Of course.
So when the heart stops pumping,
Right.
that's it. That supply is cut off.
So those neurons are basically stranded without any fuel.
Exactly. And just like a car sputtering out of gas, the brain doesn't just instantly shut off. It goes through these stages, and each stage is marked by specific changes in brain activity and the neurochemical processes that are going on.
And your research actually highlighted one study that compared it to a computer shutting down,
Yes.
but with a few kind of unexpected twists and turns along the way.
Definitely.
Okay, so let's unpack those stages a little bit because your research really kind of dove into the specifics of what happens at each point.
Yeah.
And it's not as simple as just like hitting the power button, is it?
No,
No.
it's not as simple as that at all. And the research you provided, particularly from mention a specific source, really kind of broke down those stages and the timelines that are involved. And it's actually a very rapid process. Within the first 4 minutes after blood flow to the brain stops, that's when you see the real domino effect begin.
The brain's version of Mayday, we're going down.
Exactly, exactly.
Oh.
Yeah, the initial changes happen at the cellular level because without that oxygen and glucose, the neurons can't produce the energy they need to function, and this triggers this cascade of events, starting with the release of these neurochemicals in sort of this uncontrolled
Like
burst.
everyone shouting goodbye at once.
Yes,
And
of
that's
emotion.
what creates that spike in activity.
Exactly, but it's not just the messaging, it's not just these neurochemicals, there's also a chemical component to this as well.
Okay.
And so, you know, we talked about those ions, the ones that are responsible for maintaining that electrical balance within and between the neurons.
Right, like the brain's internal wiring.
Exactly. And as that energy depletes those ions, which are usually carefully balanced, they start to go haywire. One of your sources described it as like a battery shorting out.
Oh, wow.
So that imbalance disrupts the electrical potential that allows neurons to communicate.
So it's not even just an empty tank at that point. It's like
No.
the engine itself is starting to seize up.
Yeah, and all of this is happening in the first 4 minutes.
Wow.
Yes, the brain is incredibly vulnerable to that oxygen deprivation. Now, between 4 to 10 minutes after that initial blood flow stoppage, that's when the energy depletion becomes critical. You start to see more significant changes in the brainwave patterns.
So we're shifting from that cellular level to those larger electrical patterns.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, the ones that we can actually measure.
Right. And so, you know, those high-frequency brainwaves that are associated with consciousness, those ones that you see on an EEG as this flurry of activity,
right,
as the energy dwindles, those fast waves start to give way to slower, more erratic ones.
So it's like the brain's electrical symphony is starting to sound a little more dissonant.
A very poetic way to put it.
Well, you know.
And this is where it gets really interesting, because up until fairly recently, we believed that once those brainwaves slowed to a flat line, indicating no activity on an EEG, that was it. Game over.
Right.
But your research showed that there are some groundbreaking findings that challenge that notion.
Challenging the game over. That's interesting.
Yes. And, you know, while irreversible damage does occur, there is some research that suggests there's a narrow window, particularly within the first 10 to 15 minutes, where restoring oxygen to the brain might allow for the recovery of certain basic functions.
So even after the music seems to have stopped, there might be a chance, however slim, of a faint echo remaining.
It's incredible, isn't it?
That really is incredible. Okay, I think before we move on, that's a lot to process.
It is.
So much happens in those first 15 minutes. I want to make sure I'm kind of wrapping my head around this timeline.
Yeah.
Can you maybe walk us through those critical stages once more?
Absolutely. So to quickly recap, within just 15 minutes of blood flow stopping, the brain undergoes these dramatic shifts in energy, neurochemicals, and that electrical activity.
And this is where your research on near-death experiences, those NDEs, gets even more captivating. We've been talking about these biological processes, all the nuts and bolts.
Right.
But how do those processes actually shape the experiences that people report in those NDE accounts?
Right. Well, it's like we've been looking at the hardware, yeah, you know, the nuts and bolts of the brain shutting down.
Right.
And now we're going to sort of venture into the software.
Yes.
The software of those intangible experiences of consciousness that are so hard to explain.
Exactly. And, you know, when I first started digging into the NDE research that you sent over, I have to admit, I was a little skeptical, you know?
Yeah.
Part of me just wanted to kind of write it off as hallucinations.
Sure.
Like the brain just kind of misfiring on the way out.
That's a natural reaction. Given how profoundly these experiences seem to challenge, I think our conventional understanding of what consciousness is.
But then I started noticing all these patterns, like these common threads that seem to be woven through so many of these accounts, regardless of, you know, cultural background or their personal beliefs.
Right.
And that's where I really started to get interested, especially in light of the research you sent over.
And one of the most common elements of NDEs that people report is this sensation of passing through a tunnel of light.
Right.
And your research, I particularly mention a specific source, really highlighted this fascinating connection between this phenomenon and the way the brain responds to oxygen deprivation.
So not some mystical portal to the other side.
Right.
But like a physiological response that we can actually begin to trace in the brain.
Exactly. As oxygen levels drop, the visual cortex, which is the part of the brain that processes sight, can start to malfunction.
Okay.
And this can lead to a narrowing of the visual field, sort of like tunnel vision, often accompanied by the perception of light.
So our brains, starved of oxygen, are literally creating that tunnel of light experience.
It's amazing, isn't it?
And, you know, while we're on the topic of things our oxygen-deprived brains might be making up, what about the life review?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of the NDE accounts you sent over described it as this really vivid, often very emotional kind of replay of key moments from their lives.
And, you know, your research, particularly the work of mention of specific source, suggested that there might be this really interesting link between that life review experience and the surge of neurochemicals, especially serotonin, that happens during times of extreme stress, like those final moments of life.
So it's not just random memories popping up. There's a chemical reason for this whole highlight reel of our lives.
It seems plausible. Serotonin, as you know, plays a really key role in memory and mood regulation. And so it's possible that this flood of serotonin in the brain that's triggered by this intense stress of the dying process could actually be responsible for that really intense emotional clarity and vivid memory recall that so many people report.
Wow. It's like our brains are giving us one last hurrah, one last burst of emotion before the curtain falls.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder what it all means, doesn't it?
Well, and it makes you wonder, because some of these NTEs, they go beyond just feelings and memories.
Right.
There are cases where people report specific details that they couldn't have possibly known, things they saw or heard while they were seemingly unconscious. And this so-called veridical perception that I know one of your sources called it, that's where things get really hard to wrap your head around.
Veridical perception. Yeah, the ability to accurately perceive information that you shouldn't be able to access through your normal senses has always been really controversial.
Of course.
And some researchers suggest that what might seem like psychic awareness during an NDE might actually be something called cryptomnesia.
Okay, cryptomnesia. Remind me what that is again.
So cryptomnesia is basically our brain having this hidden memory bank of information
mm-hmm.
that we don't even realize we're accessing.
So not seeing the future, but tapping into our past.
Yeah, so what seems like this big revelation during an NDE could actually be a forgotten memory. That's resurfacing. And we mistake it as a glimpse into something unknown.
Wow. It's still wild to think about just how much information our brains are constantly processing and storing.
It's incredible, and that's just one interpretation.
Right.
Your research also included some, let's say, more unconventional explanations like extrasensory perception or ESP.
Okay, so now we're getting into the really out there stuff.
I know.
Talking telepathy, clairvoyance, all those abilities that seem to defy the laws of physics as we know them.
Exactly. And while they're intriguing, it's important to approach those theories with a healthy dose of skepticism.
For sure.
We have anecdotal accounts, stories that suggest these things might be possible, but actually replicating ESP in a controlled scientific setting has been incredibly difficult.
So the jury's still out on ESP. But even if we can't explain these seemingly impossible cases of veridical perception, I think it's clear these NDEs are really pushing the boundaries of how we understand consciousness.
They really are.
Speaking of pushing boundaries, you know, your research also touched on this fascinating and slightly unnerving possibility of inducing out-of-body experiences through brain stimulation.
It sounds like science fiction, doesn't it?
It really does.
But the research you provided, particularly those studies that focus on the angular gyrus, is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Remind me what the angular gyrus is and why it's relevant to this whole out-of-body experience thing.
So the angular gyrus is this area of the brain that's really involved in processing sensory information.
Okay.
Particularly our sense of spatial awareness, our body's position in relation to everything around us.
So it's like our internal GPS.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is that researchers have found that by stimulating the angular gyrus, either through direct electrical stimulation or even in some cases transcranial magnetic stimulation, they can actually disrupt that sense of spatial awareness.
Okay, disrupt it how? Yeah. What do people experience when this part of the brain is stimulated?
Well, they report these feelings of disembodiment, like the sensation of floating outside of their physical bodies, of looking down on themselves from above.
So they're basically having a controlled, induced, out-of-body experience.
Essentially, yeah.
So by kind of tweaking the activity in this one area of the brain,
yeah,
we can create the illusion, or maybe the experience, of the self leaving the body.
It's really incredible.
It's like we're literally playing with the boundaries of consciousness.
In a sense, we are.
And it really makes you wonder, you know, if we can manipulate our experience of reality so easily through brain stimulation.
Right.
If we can change our sense of self so easily, what does that say about the relationship between the brain and consciousness?
Yeah.
You know, it's like we've gone from the detailed inner workings of neurons to these almost mystical experiences that people report when they've, you know, kind of come close to death.
Quite a range.
It really is. And it makes you think about what we really know about the brain and, you know, consciousness itself.
You know, the research you provided really highlights just how complex these questions are.
Mm-hmm.
We can map the brain's electrical activity. We can identify those chemical messengers. We can even pinpoint the areas that are responsible for certain functions.
Right.
But that essence of consciousness, you know, that subjective experience of what it feels like to be you, to be me.
Right.
That's still one of the biggest mysteries in science.
It really is. It's like we've spent all this time figuring out how to build this incredibly intricate clock.
Right.
But we still don't understand what makes time tick.
That's a great way to put it. And, you know, your research actually touched on that, on what philosophers and neuroscientists call the hard problem of consciousness.
Oh, the hard problem. Okay.
Yeah. So it's one thing to understand the neural correlates of consciousness, basically what's happening in the brain when we're having these experiences.
Right.
But explaining why those physical processes actually give rise to that feeling of awareness, to the sense of self, That's a whole other ballgame.
So how do we even begin to unpack that? I mean, are there any answers in the research that you sent, or are we just speculating here?
It's a bit of both, to be honest. Your research included a lot of different perspectives, everything from the more materialist viewpoints to those that are, let's say, a little more open to mystery.
Okay, I like it.
And on the materialist side, some neuroscientists believe that consciousness is what's called an emergent property of complex systems.
Emergent property, okay.
Yeah, and that might sound kind of complicated, but think about it this way. A single ant on its own doesn't have any kind of hive mind.
Right.
But when you have this whole colony, millions of ants interacting in these complex ways, suddenly you have this emergent property, this collective intelligence that's more than just the sum of its parts.
So you're saying that consciousness, in this view, it's like the hive mind of the brain.
Exactly.
It comes from the activity of billions of neurons, even if one neuron on its own isn't conscious.
Precisely. And that actually aligns with what we know about, for example, brain damage. Because even small lesions in specific areas can completely change our conscious experience, our personality, our sense of self.
So that really kind of emphasizes how dependent consciousness is on those physical structures.
Right, exactly.
But your research also mentioned some other views, like dualism, which is the idea that the mind and body are separate.
Yeah, dualism has been around for centuries, you know, going back to Descartes, and it basically says that consciousness, that mind, exists independently from the physical brain.
And that kind of opens up the possibility that, you know, maybe consciousness sticks around even after the body dies.
Right.
That there's something more to us than just our physical selves.
Exactly. And it's a comforting thought for a lot of people. And, you know, I know that some of the NDE accounts you shared touched on that idea.
For sure. And then there's panpsychism.
Okay.
Now, that one always kind of blows my mind a little bit.
Yeah. Panpsychism takes things even further.
Right.
Because it suggests that consciousness isn't just limited to humans or animals. It's a fundamental property of the universe itself. Yeah.
So like my coffee mug over there has some level of consciousness.
Well, that's an interesting idea, right?
Very interesting. But I mean, with all due respect to, you know, Descartes and the panpsychists, it seems like at this point we're kind of moving away from neuroscience into philosophy, maybe even spirituality.
It's true, and I think it's an important point to make. These theories are fascinating, and they offer a lot of possibilities.
Oh, sure.
They're incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to actually test scientifically right now. Neuroscience can teach us a lot about how consciousness works, the processes, the areas of the brain that are involved. But that why, that fundamental nature of subjective experience, that's still a huge mystery.
So where do we go from here? I mean, are we going to be stuck pondering this question forever? Or is there hope that maybe we'll get some answers?
You know, neuroscience is always evolving. New technologies like brain imaging, brain-computer interfaces, these are all allowing us to study consciousness in ways that we could never have imagined before.
So it's more about continuing to explore this and refining our understanding of consciousness rather than trying to definitively answer this question about what happens after we die.
Exactly. And I think every new study, every new piece of data brings us a step closer to unraveling this mystery.
And maybe that's the biggest takeaway from our deep dive today.
What's that?
That while we may never fully solve the riddle of consciousness, it's that very act of searching for an answer that makes us human.
I like that.
You know, it's what drives us to learn, to grow, to appreciate the incredible universe that we're a part of. So to everyone listening, keep asking those big questions.
Yes.
Who knows what incredible discoveries await? This has been an incredible conversation. Until next time, keep those brains buzzing.